itself were afoot these days. There were a few wagons loading at the freight cars, and several mud-splashed buggies with rough-looking strangers at the reins, but only two carriages. One was a closed carriage, the other open and occupied by a well-dressed woman and a Yankee officer. Scarlet drew in her breath sharply at the sight of the uniform. Although Pity had written that Atlanta was garrisoned and the streets full of soldiers, the first sight of the blue coat startled and frightened her. It was hard to remember that the war was over, and that this man would not pursue her, rob her, and insult her. The comparative emptiness around the train took her mind back to that morning in 1862, when she had come to Atlanta as a young widow, swathed in crepe and wild with boredom. She recalled how crowded this space had been with wagons and carriages and ambulances, and how noisy with drivers swearing and yelling and people calling greetings to friends. She sighed for the light-hearted excitement of the war days, and sighed again at the thought of walking all the way to Aunt Pity's house. But she was hopeful that once on Peachtree Street, she might meet someone she knew who would give them a ride. As she stood looking about her, a saddle-colored Negro of middle age drove the closed carriage toward her, and leaning from the box, questioned,
"Carriage, lady? 2 bits for anywhere in Atlanta."
Mammy threw him an annihilating glance.
"A hired hack," she rumbled. "Nigger, does you know who we is?"
Mammy was a country Negro, but she had not always been a country Negro, and she knew that no chaste woman ever rode in a hired conveyance, especially a closed carriage, without the escort of some male member of her family. Even the presence of a Negro maid would not satisfy the conventions. She gave Scarlet a glare as she saw her look longingly at the hack.
"Come way from there, Miss Scarlet. A hired hack and a free-issue nigger. Well, dat's a good combination."
"I ain't no free-issue nigger," declared the driver with heat. "I belongs to old Miss Talbot, and dis year her carriage, and I drives it to make money for us."
"What Miss Talbot is dat?"
"Miss Susanna Talbot of Milledgeville. Us done move up here after old Moss was killed."
"Does you know her, Miss Scarlet?"
"No," said Scarlet regretfully. "I know so few Milledgeville folks."
"Then us a walk," said Mammy sternly. "Drive on, nigger."
She picked up the carpet bag which held Scarlet's new velvet frock and bonnet and nightgown, and tucked the neat bandana bundle that contained her own belongings under her arm, and shepherded Scarlet across the wet expanse of cinders. Scarlet didn't argue the matter, much as she preferred to ride, for she wished no disagreement with Mammy. Ever since yesterday afternoon, when Mammy had caught her with the velvet curtains, there had been an alert, suspicious look in her eyes which Scarlet did not like. It was going to be difficult to escape from her chaperonage, and she didn't intend to rouse Mammy's fighting blood before it was absolutely necessary. As they walked along the narrow sidewalk toward Peachtree, Scarlet was dismayed and sorrowful, for Atlanta looked so devastated and different from what she remembered. They passed beside what had been the Atlanta Hotel, where Rhett and Uncle Henry had lived, and of that elegant hostelry there remained only a shell, a part of the blackened walls. The warehouses which had bordered the train tracks for a quarter of a mile and held tons of military supplies had not been rebuilt, and their rectangular foundations looked dreary under the dark sky. Without the wall of buildings on either side, and with a car shed gone, the railroad tracks seemed bare and exposed. Somewhere amid these ruins, undistinguishable from the others, lay what remained of her own warehouse on the property Charles had left her. Uncle Henry had paid last year's taxes on it for her. She'd have to repay that money sometime. That was something else to worry about. as they turned the corner into Peachtree Street, and she looked toward Five Points, she cried out with shock. Despite all Frank had told her about the town burning to the ground, she had never really visualized complete destruction. In her mind, the town she loved so well still stood full of close-packed buildings and fine houses. But this Peachtree Street she was looking upon was so denuded of landmarks it was as unfamiliar as if she had never seen it before. This muddy street, down which she had driven 1,000 times during the war, along which she had fled with ducked head and fear-quickened legs when shells burst over her during the siege, this street she had last seen in the heat and hurry and anguish of the day of the retreat, was so strange-looking. She felt like crying. Though many new buildings had sprung up in the year since Sherman marched out of the burning town and the Confederates returned, there were still wide, vacant lots around Five Points, where heaps of smudged broken bricks lay amid a jumble of rubbish, dead weeds, and broom sedge. There were the remains of a few buildings she remembered, roofless brick walls through which the dull daylight shone, glassless windows gaping, chimneys towering lonesomely. Here and there, her eyes gladly picked out a familiar store which had partly survived shell and fire and had been repaired, the fresh red of new brick glaring bright against the smut of the old walls. On new storefronts and new office windows, she saw the welcome names of men she knew, but more often the names were unfamiliar, especially the dozens of shingles of strange doctors and lawyers and cotton merchants. Once she had known practically everyone in Atlanta, and the sight of so many strange names depressed her. But she was cheered by the sight of new buildings going up all along the street. There were dozens of them, and several were three stories high. Everywhere building was going on, for as she looked down the street, trying to adjust her mind to the new Atlanta, she heard the blithe sound of hammers and saws, noticed scaffoldings rising, and saw men climbing ladders with hods of bricks on their shoulders. She looked down the street she loved so well, and her eyes misted a little. "They burned you," she thought, "and they laid you flat. But they didn't lick you. They couldn't lick you. You'll grow back just as big and sassy as you used to be." As she walked along Peachtree, followed by the waddling Mammy, she found the sidewalks just as crowded as they were at the height of the war, and there was the same air of rush and bustle about the resurrecting town which had made her blood sing when she came here so long ago on her first visit to Aunt Pitty. There seemed to be just as many vehicles wallowing in the mud holes as there had been then, except that there were no Confederate ambulances, and just as many horses and mules tethered to hitching racks in front of the wooden awnings of the stores. Though the sidewalks were jammed, the faces she saw were as unfamiliar as the signs overhead. New people, many rough-looking men and tawdrily dressed women. The streets were black with loafing Negroes who leaned against walls or sat on the curbing watching vehicles go past with the naive curiosity of children at a circus parade. "Free issue, country niggers," snorted Mammy. "Ain't never seen a proper carriage in their lives. And impudent-looking, too." They were impudent-looking, Scarlett agreed, for they stared at her in an insolent manner. But she forgot them in the renewed shock of seeing blue uniforms. The town was full of Yankee soldiers, on horses, afoot, in army wagons, loafing on the street, reeling out of bar rooms. "I'll never get used to them," she thought, clenching her fists. "Never." And over her shoulder, "Hurry, Mammy, let's get out of this crowd." "Soon's I kick this black trash out of my way," answered Mammy, loudly, swinging the carpet bag at a black buck who loitered tantalizingly in front of her. and making him leap aside.
"I don't like this here town, Miss Scarlet. It's too full of Yankees and cheap free issue."
"It's nicer where it isn't so crowded. When we get across 5 points, it won't be so bad." They picked their way across the slippery stepping stones that bridged the mud of Decatur Street, and continued up Peachtree through a thinning crowd. When they reached Wesley Chapel, where Scarlet had paused to catch her breath that day in 1864, when she had run for Dr. Mead, she looked at it and laughed aloud, shortly and grimly. Mammy's quick old eyes sought hers with suspicion and question. But her curiosity went unsatisfied. Scarlet was recalling with contempt the terror which had ridden her that day. She had been crawling with fear, rotten with fear, terrified by the Yankees, terrified by the approaching birth of Beau. Now she wondered how she could have been so frightened. Frightened like a child at a loud noise. And what a child she had been to think that Yankees and fire and defeat were the worst things that could happen to her. What trivialities they were beside Ellen's death and Gerald's vagueness, beside hunger and cold and back-breaking work and the living nightmare of insecurity. How easy she would find it now to be brave before an invading army, but how hard to face the danger that threatened Tara. No, she would never again be afraid of anything, except poverty. Up Peachtree came a closed carriage, and Scarlet went to the curb eagerly to see if she knew the occupant, for Aunt Pitty's house was still several blocks away. She and Mammy leaned forward as the carriage came abreast, and Scarlet, with a smile arranged, almost called out when a woman's head appeared for a moment at the window. A too bright red head beneath a fine fur hat. Scarlet took a step back as mutual recognition leaped into both faces. It was Belle Watling. And Scarlet had a glimpse of nostrils distended with dislike before she disappeared again. Strange that Belle should be the first familiar face she saw.
"Who dat?" questioned Mammy suspiciously. "She knowed you, but she didn't bow. And I ain't never seed hair dat color in my life. Not even in de Talton family. It looked... well, it looked dyed to me."
"It is," said Scarlet shortly, walking faster.
"Does you know a dyed-haired woman? I asked you who she is."
"She's the town bad woman," said Scarlet briefly. "And I give you my word, I don't know her, so shut up."
"God almighty," breathed Mammy,
her jaw dropping as she looked after the carriage with passionate curiosity. She hadn't seen a professional bad woman since she left Savannah with Ellen more than 20 years before, and she wished ardently that she had observed Belle more closely.
"She sure dressed up fine and got a fine carriage and coachman," she muttered. "I don't know what the Lord thinking about, letting the bad women flourish like that when us good folks is hungry and most barefoot."
"The Lord stopped thinking about us years ago," said Scarlet savagely. "And don't go telling me mother is turning in her grave to hear me say it, either." She wanted to feel superior and virtuous about Belle, but she could not. If her plans went well, she might be on the same footing with Belle and supported by the same man. While she didn't regret her decision one whit, the matter in its true light discomfited her. "I won't think of it now," she told herself, and hurried her steps. They passed the lot where the Mead house had stood, and there remained of it only a forlorn pair of stone steps and a walk, leading up to nothing. Where the Whitings' home had been was bare ground. Even the foundation stones and the brick chimneys were gone, and there were wagon tracks where they had been carted away. The brick house of the Elsings still stood, with a new roof and a new second floor. The Bunnell home, awkwardly patched and roofed with rude boards instead of shingles, managed to look livable for all its battered appearance. But in neither house was there a face at the window, or a figure on the porch. And Scarlett was glad. She didn't want to talk to anyone now. Then the new slate roof of Aunt Pitty's house came in view, with its red brick walls, and Scarlett's heart throbbed. How good of the Lord not to level it beyond repair! Coming out of the front yard was Uncle Peter, a market basket on his arm. And when he saw Scarlett and Mammy trudging along, a wide, incredulous smile split his black face. "I could kiss the old black fool. I'm so glad to see him," thought Scarlett, joyfully, and she called, "Run! Get Auntie's swoon bottle, Peter. It's really me!" That night, the inevitable hominy and dried peas were on Aunt Pitty's supper table, and as Scarlett ate them, she made a vow that these two dishes would never appear on her table when she had money again. And no matter what price she had to pay, she was going to have money again. More than just enough to pay the taxes on Tara. Somehow, someday, she was going to have plenty of money if she had to commit murder to get it. In the yellow lamplight of the dining room, she asked Pitty about her finances, hoping against hope that Charles's family might be able to lend her the money she needed. The questions were none too subtle, but Pitty, in her pleasure at having a member of the family to talk to, didn't even notice the bald way the questions were put. She plunged with tears into the details of her misfortunes. She just didn't know where her farms and town property and money had gone, but everything had slipped away. At least, that was what Brother Henry told her. He hadn't been able to pay the taxes on her estate. Everything except the house she was living in was gone. And Pitty didn't stop to think that the house had never been hers, but was the joint property of Melanie and Scarlett. Brother Henry could just barely pay taxes on this house. He gave her a little something every month to live on, and though it was very humiliating to take money from him, she had to do it. "Brother Henry says he doesn't know how he'll make ends meet with the load he's carrying, and taxes so high, but of course he's probably lying and has loads of money and just won't give me much." Scarlett knew Uncle Henry wasn't lying. The few letters she had had from him in connection with Charles's property showed that. The old lawyer was battling valiantly to save the house and the one piece of downtown property where the warehouse had been, so Wade and Scarlett would have something left from the wreckage. Scarlett knew he was carrying these taxes for her at a great sacrifice. "Of course he hasn't any money," thought Scarlett grimly. "Well, check him and Aunt Pitty off my list. There's nobody left but Rhett. I'll have to do it. I must do it. But I mustn't think about it now. I must get her to talking about Rhett so I can casually suggest to her to invite him to call tomorrow." She smiled and squeezed the plump palms of Aunt Pitty between her own. "Darling Auntie," she said, "don't let's talk about distressing things like money any more. Let's forget about them and talk of pleasanter things. You must tell me all the news about our old friends. How is Mrs. Merriweather and Maybelle? I heard that Maybelle's little Creole came home safely. How are the Elsings and Dr. and Mrs. Meade?" Pitty-Pat brightened at the change of subject, and her baby face stopped quivering with tears. She gave detailed reports about old neighbors, what they were doing and wearing and eating and thinking. She told with accents of horror how, before Renee Picard came home from the war, Mrs. Merriweather and Maybelle had made ends meet by baking pies and selling them to the Yankee soldiers. Imagine that! Sometimes there were 24 Yankees standing in the backyard of the Merriweather home, waiting for the baking to be finished. Now that Renee was home, he drove an old wagon to the Yankee camp every day and sold cakes and pies and beaten biscuits to the soldiers. Mrs. Merriweather said that when she made a little more money, she was going to open a bake shop downtown. Pity didn't wish to criticize, but after all... As for herself, said Pity, she would rather starve than have such commerce with Yankees. She made a point of giving a disdainful look to every soldier she met, and crossed to the other side of the street in as insulting a manner as possible, though, she said, this was quite inconvenient in wet weather. Scarlet gathered that no sacrifice, even though it be muddy shoes, was too great to show loyalty to the Confederacy, insofar as Miss Pittypat was concerned. Mrs. Meade and the doctor had lost their home when the Yankees fired the town, and they had neither the money nor the heart to rebuild, now that Phil and Darcy were dead. Mrs. Meade said she never wanted a home again, for what was a home without children and grandchildren in it? They were very lonely, and had gone to live with the Elsings, who had rebuilt the damaged part of their home. Mr. and Mrs. Whiting had a room there, too, and Mrs. Bunnell was talking of moving in if she was fortunate enough to rent her house to a Yankee officer and his family. "But how do they all squeeze in?" cried Scarlet. "There's Mrs. Elsing and Fanny and Hugh." "Mrs. Elsing and Fanny sleep in the parlor and Hugh in the attic," explained Pity, who knew the domestic arrangements of all her friends. "My dear, I do hate to tell you this, but Mrs. Elsing calls them paying guests, but..." Pity dropped her voice. "They're really nothing at all except boarders. Mrs. Elsing is running a boarding house. Isn't that dreadful?"
"I think it's wonderful," said Scarlet shortly.
"I only wish we'd had paying guests at Tara for the last year instead of free boarders. Maybe we wouldn't be so poor now."
"Scarlet, how can you say such things? Your poor mother must be turning in her grave at the very thought of charging money for the hospitality of Tara. Of course, Mrs. Elsing was simply forced to it because, while she took in fine sewing and Fanny painted china and Hugh made a little money peddling firewood, they couldn't make ends meet. Imagine darling Hugh forced to peddle wood. And he all set to be a fine lawyer. I could just cry at the things our boys are reduced to."
Scarlet thought of the rows of cotton beneath the glaring coppery sky at Tara, and how her back had ached as she bent over them. She remembered the feel of plough handles between her inexperienced, blistered palms, and she felt that Hugh Elsing was deserving of no special sympathy. What an innocent old fool Pity was. And despite the ruin all around her, how sheltered.
"If he doesn't like peddling, why doesn't he practice law? Or isn't there any law practice left in Atlanta?"
"Oh, dear, yes. There's plenty of law practice. Practically everybody is suing everybody else these days. With everything burned down and boundary lines wiped out, no one knows just where their land begins or ends. But you can't get any pay for suing because nobody has any money. So Hugh sticks to his peddling. Oh, I almost forgot. Did I write you? Fanny Elsing is getting married tomorrow night, and of course you must attend. Mrs. Elsing will be only too pleased to have you when she knows you're in town. I do hope you have some other frock besides that one. Not that it isn't a very sweet frock, darling, but, well, it does look a bit worn. Oh, you have a pretty frock?
I'm so glad, because it's going to be the first real wedding we've had in Atlanta since before the town fell. Cake and wine and dancing afterwards. Though I don't know how the Elsings can afford it. They're so poor. Who is Fanny marrying? I thought after Dallas McClure was killed at Gettysburg.
Darling, you mustn't criticize Fanny. Everybody isn't as loyal to the dead as you are to poor Charlie.
Let me see. What is his name? I can never remember names. Tom, somebody. I knew his mother well. We went to LaGrange Female Institute together. She was a Tomlinson from LaGrange, and her mother was, let me see, Perkins? Parkins?
Parkinson, that's it, from Sparta. A very good family, but just the same. Well, I know I shouldn't say it, but I don't see how Fanny can bring herself to marry him.
Does he drink, or...
Dear, no. His character is perfect, but you see, he was wounded low down by a bursting shell, and it did something to his legs. Makes them, well, I hate to use the word, but it makes him spraddle. It gives him a very vulgar appearance when he walks. Well, it doesn't look very pretty. I don't see why she's marrying him. Girls have to marry someone.
Indeed they do not, said Pity, ruffling.
I never had to. Now, darling, I didn't mean you. Everybody knows how popular you were, and still are. Why, old Judge Carlton used to throw sheep's eyes at you till I...
Oh, Scarlet, hush, that old fool, giggled Pity, good humor restored.
But after all, Fanny was so popular, she could have made a better match, and I don't believe she loves this Tom... what's his name? I don't believe she's ever gotten over Dallas McClure getting killed. But she's not like you, darling. You've remained so faithful to dear Charlie, though you could have married dozens of times. Melly and I have often said how loyal you were to his memory when everyone else said you were just a heartless coquette.
Scarlet passed over this tactless confidence, and skillfully led Pity from one friend to another. But all the while she was in a fever of impatience to bring the conversation around to Rhett. It would never do for her to ask outright about him so soon after arriving. It might start the old lady's mind to working on channels better left untouched. There would be time enough for Pity's suspicions to be aroused if Rhett refused to marry her. And Pity prattled on happily, pleased as a child at having an audience. Things in Atlanta were in a dreadful pass, she said, due to the vile doings of the Republicans. There was no end to their goings-on, and the worst thing was the way they were putting ideas in the poor darkies' heads.
My dear, they want to let the darkies vote. Did you ever hear of anything more silly? Though, I don't know. Now that I think about it, Uncle Peter has much more sense than any Republican I ever saw, and much better manners, but of course Uncle Peter is far too well-bred to want to vote. But the very notion has upset the darkies till they're right addled. And some of them are so insolent. Your life isn't safe on the streets after dark, and even in the broad daylight they push ladies off the sidewalks into the mud. And if any gentleman dares to protest, they arrest him and... My dear, did I tell you that Captain Butler was in jail? Rhett Butler?
Even with this startling news, Scarlet was grateful that Aunt Pity had saved her the necessity of bringing his name into the conversation herself.
Yes, indeed. Excitement colored Pity's cheeks pink, and she sat upright. He's in jail this very minute for killing a Negro, and they may hang him. Imagine Captain Butler hanging.
For a moment, the breath went out of Scarlet's lungs in a sickening gasp, and she could only stare at the fat old lady who was so obviously pleased at the effect of her statement.
They haven't proved it yet, but somebody killed this darky who had insulted a white woman. And the Yankees are very upset because so many uppity darkies have been killed recently. They can't prove it on Captain Butler, but they want to make an example of someone, so Dr. Meade says. The doctor says that if they do hang him, it will be the first good, honest job the Yankees ever did. But then, I don't know. And to think that Captain Butler was here just a week ago and brought me the loveliest quail you ever saw for a present, and he was asking about you and saying he feared he had offended you during the siege and you would never forgive him. How long will he be in jail?
Nobody knows. Perhaps till they hang him. But
Maybe they won't be able to prove the killing on him after all. However, it doesn't seem to bother the Yankees whether folks are guilty or not, so long as they can hang somebody. They're so upset. Pity dropped her voice mysteriously about the Ku Klux Klan. Do you have the Klan down in the county? My dear, I'm sure you must, and Ashley just doesn't tell you girls anything about it. Klansmen aren't supposed to tell. They ride around at night dressed up like ghosts and call on carpetbaggers who steal money and Negroes who are uppity. Sometimes they just scare them and warn them to leave Atlanta. But when they don't behave, they whip them and... Pity whispered. Sometimes they kill them and leave them where they'll be easily found with a Ku Klux card on them. And the Yankees are very angry about it and want to make an example of someone. But Hugh Elsing told me he didn't think they'd hang Captain Butler because the Yankees think he does know where the money is and just won't tell. They're trying to make him tell. The money? Didn't you know? Didn't I write you? My dear, you have been buried at Terra, haven't you? The town simply buzzed when Captain Butler came back here with a fine horse and carriage and his pockets full of money, when all the rest of us didn't know where our next meal was coming from. It simply made everybody furious that an old speculator who always said nasty things about the Confederacy should have so much money when we were all so poor. Everybody was bursting to know how he managed to save his money, but no one had the courage to ask him, except me, and he just laughed and said, "In no honest way, you may be sure. You know how hard it is to get anything sensible out of him." "But of course he made his money out of the blockade." "Of course he did, honey, some of it. But that's not a drop in the bucket to what that man has really got. Everybody, including the Yankees, believes he's got millions of dollars in gold belonging to the Confederate government hid out somewhere." "Millions? In gold? Well, honey, where did all our Confederate gold go to? Somebody got it, and Captain Butler must be one of the somebodies. The Yankees thought President Davis had it when he left Richmond, but when they captured the poor man, he had hardly a cent. There just wasn't any money in the treasury when the war was over, and everybody thinks some of the blockade runners got it and are keeping quiet about it. Millions in gold. But how? Didn't Captain Butler take thousands of bales of cotton to England and Nassau to sell for the Confederate government?" asked Pity triumphantly. "Not only his own cotton, but government cotton, too. And you know what cotton brought in England during the war. Any price you wanted to ask. He was a free agent acting for the government, and he was supposed to sell the cotton and buy guns with the money and run the guns in for us. Well, when the blockade got too tight, he couldn't bring in the guns, and he couldn't have spent 1/100th of the cotton money on them anyway. So there were simply millions of dollars in English banks put there by Captain Butler and other blockaders, waiting till the blockade loosened. And you can't tell me they banked that money in the name of the Confederacy. They put it in their own names, and it's still there. Everybody's been talking about it ever since the surrender, and criticizing the blockaders severely. And when the Yankees arrested Captain Butler for killing this darky, they must have heard the rumor, because they've been at him to tell them where the money is. You see, all of our Confederate funds belong to the Yankees now. At least, the Yankees think so. But Captain Butler says he doesn't know anything. Dr. Meade says they ought to hang him anyhow. Only hanging is too good for a thief and a profiteer. Dear, you look so oddly. Do you feel faint? Have I upset you talking like this? I knew he was a beau of yours, but I thought you'd fallen out long ago. Personally, I never approved of him, for he's such a scamp. He's no friend of mine, said Scarlet with an effort. I had a quarrel with him during the siege, after you went to Macon. Where is he?
In the firehouse, over near the public square. In the firehouse? Aunt Pity crowed with laughter.
Yes, he's in the firehouse. The Yankees use it for a military jail now. The Yankees are camped in huts all around the city hall, in the square, and the firehouse is just down the street, so that's where Captain Butler is. And Scarlett, I heard the funniest thing yesterday about Captain Butler. I forget who told me. You know how well-groomed he always was, really a dandy. And they've been keeping him in the firehouse and not letting him bathe. And every day he's been insisting that he wanted a bath. And finally they let him out of his cell onto the square, and there was a long horse trough where the whole regiment had bathed in the same water. And they told him he could bathe there, and he said no, that he preferred his own brand of southern dirt to Yankee dirt, and...
Scarlett heard the cheerful babbling voice going on and on, but she did not hear the words. In her mind, there were only two ideas. Rhett had more money than she had even hoped, and he was in jail. The fact that he was in jail and possibly might be hanged changed the face of matters somewhat. In fact, it made them look a little brighter. She had very little feeling about Rhett being hanged. Her need of money was too pressing, too desperate, for her to bother about his ultimate fate. Besides, she half-shared Dr. Meade's opinion that hanging was too good for him. Any man who'd leave a woman stranded between two armies in the middle of the night, just to go off and fight for a cause already lost, deserved hanging. If she could somehow manage to marry him while he was in jail, all those millions would be hers, and hers alone, should he be executed. And if marriage was not possible, perhaps she could get a loan from him by promising to marry him when he was released, or by promising anything. And if they hanged him, her day of settlement would never come. For a moment her imagination flamed at the thought of being made a widow by the kindly intervention of the Yankee government. Millions in gold. She could repair Terra and hire hands and plant miles and miles of cotton. And she could have pretty clothes and all she wanted to eat, and so could Sue Ellen and Corrine. And Wade could have nourishing food to fill out his thin cheeks and warm clothes and a governess and afterward go to the university and not grow up barefooted and ignorant like a cracker. And a good doctor could look after Paul. And as for Ashley, what couldn't she do for Ashley? Aunt Pittypat's monologue broke off suddenly as she said inquiringly, "Yes, Mammy?" And Scarlett, coming back from dreams, saw Mammy standing in the doorway, her hands under her apron and in her eyes an alert, piercing look. She wondered how long Mammy had been standing there, and how much she had heard and observed. Probably everything, to judge by the gleam in her old eyes. "Miss Scarlett look like she tired. I spec she better go to bed." "I am tired," said Scarlett, rising and meeting Mammy's eyes with a childlike, helpless look. "And I'm afraid I'm catching a cold, too. Aunt Pity, would you mind if I stayed in bed tomorrow and didn't go calling with you? I can go calling any time, and I'm so anxious to go to Fanny's wedding tomorrow night. And if my cold gets worse, I won't be able to go. And a day in bed would be such a lovely treat for me." Mammy's look changed to faint worry as she felt Scarlett's hands and looked into her face. She certainly didn't look well. The excitement of her thoughts had abruptly ebbed, leaving her white and shaking.
"Your hands like ice, honey. You come to bed, and I'll brew you some sassafras tea and get you a hot brick to make you sweat."
"How thoughtless I've been," cried the plump old lady, hopping from her chair and patting Scarlett's arm. "Just chattering on and not thinking of you. Honey, you shall stay in bed all tomorrow and rest up, and we can gossip together." "Oh, dear, no, I can't be with you. I've promised to sit with Mrs. Bunnell tomorrow. She is down with la grippe, and so is her cook. Mammy, I'm so glad you are here. You must go over with me in the morning and help me."
Mammy hurried Scarlet up the dark stairs, muttering fussy remarks about cold hands and thin shoes, and Scarlet looked meek and was well content. If she could only lull Mammy's suspicions further and get her out of the house in the morning, all would be well. Then she could go to the Yankee jail and see Rhett. As she climbed the stairs, the faint rumbling of thunder began, and standing on the well-remembered landing, she thought how like the siege cannon it sounded. She shivered. Forever, thunder would mean cannon and war to her. Chapter 34. The sun shone intermittently in the next morning, and the hard wind that drove dark clouds swiftly across its face rattled the window panes and moaned faintly about the house. Scarlet said a brief prayer of thanksgiving that the rain of the previous night had ceased, for she had lain awake listening to it, knowing that it would mean the ruin of her velvet dress and new bonnet. Now that she could catch fleeting glimpses of the sun, her spirits soared. She could hardly remain in bed and look languid and make croaking noises until Aunt Pitty, Mammy, and Uncle Peter were out of the house and on their way to Mrs. Bunnell's. When, at last, the front gate banged and she was alone in the house, except for Cookie, who was singing in the kitchen, she leaped from the bed and lifted her new clothes from the closet hooks. Sleep had refreshed her and given her strength, and from the cold, hard core at the bottom of her heart, she drew courage. There was something about the prospect of a struggle of wits with a man, with any man, that put her on her mettle. And after months of battling against countless discouragements, the knowledge that she was at last facing a definite adversary, one whom she might unhorse by her own efforts, gave her a buoyant sensation. Dressing unaided was difficult, but she finally accomplished it, and putting on the bonnet with its rakish feathers, she ran to Aunt Pitty's room to preen herself in front of the long mirror. How pretty she looked! The cock feathers gave her a dashing air, and the dull green velvet of the bonnet made her eyes startlingly bright, almost emerald-colored. And the dress was incomparable. So rich and handsome-looking, and yet so dignified. It was wonderful to have a lovely dress again. It was so nice to know that she looked pretty and provocative, and she impulsively bent forward and kissed her reflection in the mirror, and then laughed at her own foolishness. She picked up Ellen's paisley shawl to wrap around her, but the colors of the faded old square clashed with the moss-green dress, and made her appear a little shabby. Opening Aunt Pitty's closet, she removed a black broadcloth cloak, a thin fall garment which Pitty used only for Sunday wear, and put it on. She slipped into her pierced ears the diamond earrings she had brought from Terra, and tossed her head to observe the effect. They made pleasant clicking noises which were very satisfactory, and she thought that she must remember to toss her head frequently when with Rhett. Dancing earrings always attracted a man, and gave a girl such a spirited air. What a shame Aunt Pitty had no other gloves than the ones now on her fat hands. No woman could really feel like a lady without gloves, but Scarlet had not had a pair since she left Atlanta, and the long months of hard work at Terra had roughened her hands, until they were far from pretty. Well, it couldn't be helped. She'd take Aunt Pitty's little seal muff and hide her bare hands in it. Scarlet felt that it gave her the final finishing touch of elegance. No one, looking at her now, would suspect that poverty and want were standing at her shoulder. It was so important that Rhett should not suspect. He mustn't think that anything but tender feelings were driving her. She tiptoed down the stairs and out of the house, while Cookie bawled on unconcernedly in the kitchen. She hastened down Baker Street to avoid the all-seeing eyes of the neighbors, and sat down on a carriage block on Ivy Street, in front of a burned house, to wait for some passing carriage or wagon which would give her a ride. The sun dipped in and out from behind hurrying clouds, lighting the street with a false brightness which had no warmth in it, and the wind fluttered the lace of her pantalettes. It was colder than she had expected, and she wrapped Aunt Pitty's thin cloak about her and shivered impatiently. Just as she was preparing to start walking the long way across town to the Yankee encampment, a battered wagon appeared. In it was an old woman with a lip full of snuff and a weather-beaten face under a drab sunbonnet, driving a dawdling old mule. She was going in the direction of the city hall, and she grudgingly gave Scarlet a ride. But it was obvious that the dress, bonnet, and muff found no favor with her. "She thinks I'm a hussy," thought Scarlet. "And perhaps she's right at that." When at last they reached the town square, and the tall white cupola of the city hall loomed up, she made her thanks, climbed down from the wagon, and watched the countrywoman drive off. Looking around carefully to see that she was not observed, she pinched her cheeks to give them color, and bit her lips until they stung to make them red. She adjusted the bonnet and smoothed back her hair, and looked about the square. The two-story red-brick city hall had survived the burning of the city, but it looked forlorn and unkempt under the gray sky. Surrounding the building completely, and covering the square of land of which it was the center, were row after row of army huts, dingy and mud-splashed. Yankee soldiers loitered everywhere, and Scarlet looked at them uncertainly, some of her courage deserting her. How would she go about finding Rhett in this enemy camp? She looked down the street toward the firehouse, and saw that the wide arched doors were closed and heavily barred, and two sentries passed and repassed on each side of the building. Rhett was in there. But what should she say to the Yankee soldiers? And what would they say to her? She squared her shoulders. If she hadn't been afraid to kill one Yankee, she shouldn't fear merely talking to another. She picked her way precariously across the stepping stones of the muddy street, and walked forward until a sentry, his blue overcoat buttoned high against the wind, stopped her. "What is it, ma'am?" His voice had a strange Midwestern twang, but it was polite and respectful. "I want to see a man in there. He's a prisoner." "Well, I don't know," said the sentry, scratching his head. "They are mighty particular about visitors, and—" He stopped and peered into her face sharply. "Lord, lady, don't you cry. You go over to post headquarters and ask the officers. They'll let you see him, I bet." Scarlet, who had no intention of crying, beamed at him. He turned to another sentry who was slowly pacing his beat. "Ye all, Bill, come here." The second sentry, a large man muffled in a blue overcoat from which villainous black whiskers burst, came through the mud toward them. "You take this lady to headquarters." Scarlet thanked him and followed the sentry. "Mind you don't turn your ankle on those stepping stones," said the soldier, taking her arm. "And you'd better hoist up your skirts a little to keep them out of the mud." The voice issuing from the whiskers had the same nasal twang, but was kind and pleasant, and his hand was firm and respectful. Why, Yankees weren't bad at all. "It's a mighty cold day for a lady to be out in," said her escort. "Have you come a fur piece?" "Oh, yes, from clear across the other side of town," she said, warming to the kindness in his voice.
"This ain't no weather for a lady to be out in," said the soldier reprovingly, "with all this la grippe in the air. Here's post command, lady. What's the matter?"
This house is your headquarters?" Scarlett looked up at the lovely old dwelling facing on the square and could have cried. She had been to so many parties in this house during the war. It had been a gay, beautiful place, and now there was a large United States flag floating over it.
"What's the matter?"
"Nothing. Only, I used to know the people who lived here."
"Well, that's too bad. I guess they wouldn't know it themselves if they saw it, for it sure is torn up on the inside. Now you go on in, ma'am, and ask for the captain."
She went up the steps, caressing the broken white banisters, and pushed open the front door. The hall was dark and as cold as a vault, and a shivering sentry was leaning against the closed folding doors of what had been, in better days, the dining room. "I want to see the captain," she said. He pulled back the doors and she entered the room, her heart beating rapidly, her face flushing with embarrassment and excitement. There was a close, stuffy smell in the room, compounded of the smoking fire, tobacco fumes, leather, damp woolen uniforms, and unwashed bodies. She had a confused impression of bare walls with torn wallpaper, rows of blue overcoats and slouch hats hung on nails, a roaring fire, a long table covered with papers, and a group of officers in blue uniforms with brass buttons. She gulped once and found her voice. She mustn't let these Yankees know she was afraid. She must look and be her prettiest and most unconcerned self. "The captain?"
"I'm one captain," said a fat man whose tunic was unbuttoned.
"I want to see a prisoner, Captain Rhett Butler."
"Butler again? He's popular, that man," laughed the captain, taking a chewed cigar from his mouth. "You a relative, ma'am?"
"Yes, his sister."
He laughed again. "He's got a lot of sisters. One of them here yesterday."
Scarlett flushed. One of those creatures Rhett consorted with, probably that Watling woman. And these Yankees thought she was another one. It was unendurable. Not even for Tara would she stay here another minute and be insulted. She turned to the door and reached angrily for the knob, but another officer was by her side quickly. He was clean-shaven and young, and had merry, kind eyes.
"Just a minute, ma'am. Won't you sit down here by the fire where it's warm? I'll go see what I can do about it. What's your name?" He refused to see the lady who called yesterday.
She sank into the proffered chair, glaring at the discomforted fat captain, and gave her name. The nice young officer slipped on his overcoat and left the room, and the others took themselves off to the far end of the table where they talked in low tones and pawed at the papers. She stretched her feet gratefully toward the fire, realizing for the first time how cold they were, and wishing she had thought to put a piece of cardboard over the hole in the sole of one slipper. After a time, voices murmured outside the door, and she heard Rhett's laugh. The door opened. A cold draft swept the room, and Rhett appeared, hatless, a long cape thrown carelessly across his shoulders. He was dirty and unshaven, and without a cravat, but somehow jaunty despite his dishabille. And his dark eyes were snapping joyfully at the sight of her.
"Scarlett!"
He had her hands in both of his, and as always, there was something hot and vital and exciting about his grip. Before she quite knew what he was about, he had bent and kissed her cheek,
his moustache tickling her. As he felt the startled movement of her body away from him, he hugged her about the shoulders and said, "My darling little sister," and grinned down at her as if he relished her helplessness in resisting his caress. She couldn't help laughing back at him for the advantage he had taken. What a rogue he was! Jail had not changed him one bit. The fat captain was muttering through his cigar to the merry-eyed officer. "Most irregular. He should be in the firehouse. You know the orders." "Oh, for God's sake, Henry. The lady would freeze in that barn." "Oh, all right, all right. It's your responsibility."
"I assure you, gentlemen," said Rhett, turning to them but still keeping a grip on Scarlett's shoulders, "my sister hasn't brought me any saws or files to help me escape."
They all laughed, and as they did, Scarlett looked quickly about her. Good heavens! Was she going to have to talk to Rhett before 6 Yankee officers? Was he so dangerous a prisoner they wouldn't let him out of their sight? Seeing her anxious glance, the nice officer pushed open a door and spoke brief low words to 2 privates, who had leaped to their feet at his entrance. They picked up their rifles and went out into the hall, closing the door behind them.
"If you wish, you may sit here in the orderly room," said the young captain. "And don't try to bolt through that door. The men are just outside."
"You see what a desperate character I am, Scarlett," said Rhett.
"Thank you, Captain. This is most kind of you."
He bowed carelessly, and taking Scarlett's arm, pulled her to her feet and propelled her into the dingy orderly room. She was never to remember what the room looked like, except that it was small and dim and none too warm, and there were handwritten papers tacked on the mutilated walls and chairs which had cowhide seats with a hair still on them. When he had closed the door behind them, Rhett came to her swiftly and bent over her. Knowing his desire, she turned her head quickly but smiled provocatively at him out of the corners of her eyes.
"Can't I really kiss you now?"
"On the forehead, like a good brother," she answered demurely.
"Thank you, no. I prefer to wait and hope for better things."
His eyes sought her lips and lingered there a moment.
"But how good of you to come to see me, Scarlett. You are the first respectable citizen who's called on me since my incarceration. And being in jail makes one appreciate friends. When did you come to town?"
"Yesterday afternoon."
"And you came out this morning? Why, my dear, you are more than good." He smiled down at her with the first expression of honest pleasure she had ever seen on his face. Scarlett smiled inwardly with excitement and ducked her head as if embarrassed.
"Of course, I came out right away. Aunt Pitty told me about you last night, and I just couldn't sleep all night for thinking how awful it was. Rhett, I'm so distressed."
"Why, Scarlett."
His voice was soft, but there was a vibrant note in it. And looking up into his dark face, she saw in it none of the skepticism, the jeering humor she knew so well. Before his direct gaze, her eyes fell again in real confusion. Things were going even better than she hoped.
"It's worth being in jail to see you again and to hear you say things like that. I really couldn't believe my ears when they brought me your name. You see, I never expected you to forgive me for my patriotic conduct that night on the road near Rough and Ready. But I take it that this call means you have forgiven me."
She could feel swift anger stir, even at this late date, as she thought of that night. But she subdued it and tossed her head until the earrings danced.
"No, I haven't forgiven you," she said, and pouted.
"Another hope crushed. And after I offered up myself for my country and fought barefooted in the snow at Franklin and got the finest case of dysentery you ever heard of for my pains.
I don't want to hear about your pains,
she said, still pouting but smiling at him from tip-tilted eyes. I still think you were hateful that night, and I never expect to forgive you. Leaving me alone like that when anything might have happened to me.
But nothing did happen to you.
So you see, my confidence in you was justified. I knew you'd get home safely, and God help any Yankee who got in your way.
Rhett, why on earth did you do such a silly thing? Enlisting at the last minute when you knew we were going to get licked. And after all you'd said about idiots who went out and got shot.
Scarlet, spare me. I'm always overcome with shame when I think about it.
Well, I'm glad to learn you're ashamed of the way you treated me.
You misunderstand. I regret to say that my conscience has not troubled me at all about deserting you. But as for enlisting, when I think of joining the army in varnished boots and a white linen suit and armed with only a pair of dueling pistols, and those long cold miles in the snow after my boots wore out and I had no overcoat and nothing to eat, I cannot understand why I did not desert. It was all the purest insanity. But it's in one's blood. Southerners can never resist a losing cause. But never mind my reasons. It's enough that I'm forgiven.
You're not. I think you're a hound.
But she caressed the last word until it might have been darling.
Don't fib. You've forgiven me.
Young ladies don't dare Yankee sentries to see a prisoner just for charity's sweet sake, and come all dressed up in velvet and feathers and seal muffs, too.
Scarlet, how pretty you look.
Thank God you aren't in rags or mourning. I get so sick of women in dowdy old clothes and perpetual crepe.
You look like the Rue de la Paix. Turn around, my dear, and let me look at you.
So he had noticed the dress.
Of course he would notice such things being red. She laughed in soft excitement and spun about on her toes, her arms extended, her hoops tilting up to show her lace-trimmed pantalettes. His black eyes took her in from bonnet to heels in a glance that missed nothing. That old impudent, unclothing glance which always gave her goosebumps.
You look very prosperous and very, very tidy. And almost good enough to eat. If it wasn't for the Yankees outside. But you are quite safe, my dear. Sit down. I won't take advantage of you as I did the last time I saw you.
He rubbed his cheek with pseudo-ruefulness.
Honestly, Scarlet, don't you think you were a bit selfish that night? Think of all I had done for you, risked my life, stolen a horse, and such a horse. Rushed to the defense of our glorious cause. And what did I get for my pains? Some hard words and a very hard slap in the face.
She sat down. The conversation was not going in quite the direction she hoped. He had seemed so nice when he first saw her, so genuinely glad she had come. He had almost seemed like a human being, and not the perverse wretch she knew so well.
Must you always get something for your pains?
Why, of course. I am a monster of selfishness, as you ought to know. I always expect payment for anything I give.
That sent a slight chill through her. But she rallied and jingled her earbobs again.
Oh, you really aren't so bad, Rhett. You just like to show off.
My word, but you have changed, he said, and laughed. What has made a Christian of you? I've kept up with you through Miss Pittypat, but you gave me no intimation that you had developed womanly sweetness.
Tell me more about yourself, Scarlet. What have you been doing since I last saw you?
The old irritation and antagonism which he roused in her was hot in her heart, and she yearned to speak tart words. But she smiled instead, and the dimple crept into her cheek. He had drawn a chair close beside hers, and she leaned over and put a gentle hand on his arm in an unconscious manner.
"Oh, I've been doing nicely, thank you. And everything at Terra is fine now. Of course, we had a dreadful time right after Sherman went through, but after all, he didn't burn the house, and the darkies saved most of the livestock by driving it into the swamp. And we cleared a fair crop this last fall, 20 bales. Of course, that's practically nothing compared with what Terra can do, but we haven't many field hands. Pa says, of course, we'll do better next year. But, Rhett, it's so dull in the country now. Imagine, there aren't any balls or barbecues, and the only thing people talk about is hard times. Goodness, I get sick of it. Finally, last week, I got too bored to stand it any longer, so Pa said I must take a trip and have a good time. So I came up here to get me some frocks made, and then I'm going over to Charleston to visit my aunt. It'll be lovely to go to balls again. There, she thought with pride. I delivered that with just the right airy way. Not too rich, but certainly not poor.
You look beautiful in ball dresses, my dear, and you know it, too. Worse luck. I suppose the real reason you're going visiting is that you have run through the county swains and are seeking fresh ones in fields afar.
Scarlet had a thankful thought that Rhett had spent the last several months abroad and had only recently come back to Atlanta. Otherwise, he would never have made so ridiculous a statement. She thought briefly of the county swains, the ragged, embittered little Fontaines, the poverty-stricken Monroe boys, the Jonesboro and Fayetteville beaux, who were so busy plowing, splitting rails, and nursing sick old animals, that they had forgotten such things as balls and pleasant flirtations ever existed. But she put down this memory and giggled self-consciously, as if admitting the truth of his assertion. "Oh, well," she said deprecatingly. "You are a heartless creature, Scarlet, but perhaps that's part of your charm." He smiled in his old way, one corner of his mouth curving down. But she knew he was complimenting her. "For, of course, you know you have more charm than the law should permit. Even I have felt it, case-hardened though I am. I've often wondered what it was about you that made me always remember you. For I've known many ladies who were prettier than you, and certainly more clever, and, I fear, morally more upright and kind. But somehow, I always remembered you. Even during the months since the surrender, when I was in France and England, and hadn't seen you or heard of you, and was enjoying the society of many beautiful ladies, I always remembered you, and wondered what you were doing." For a moment she was indignant that he should say other women were prettier, more clever and kind than she. But that momentary flare was wiped out in her pleasure that he had remembered her and her charm. So he hadn't forgotten. That would make things easier. And he was behaving so nicely, almost like a gentleman would do under the circumstances. Now, all she had to do was bring the subject around to himself, so she could intimate that she had not forgotten him either, and then... She gently squeezed his arm and dimpled again. "Oh, Rhett, how you do run on teasing a country girl like me. I know mighty well you never gave me a thought after you left me that night. You can't tell me you ever thought of me with all those pretty French and English girls around you. But I didn't come all the way out here to hear you talk foolishness about me. I came because
Because? Oh, Rhett, I'm so terribly distressed about you, so frightened for you. When will they let you out of that terrible place?
He swiftly covered her hand with his and held it hard against his arm.
Your distress does you credit. There's no telling when I'll be out. Probably when they've stretched the rope a bit more.
The rope?
Yes. I expect to make my exit from here at the rope's end.
They won't really hang you.
They will if they can get a little more evidence against me.
Oh, Rhett! She cried, her hand at her heart.
Would you be sorry? If you're sorry enough, I'll mention you in my will. His dark eyes laughed at her recklessly, and he squeezed her hand.
His will? She hastily cast down her eyes for fear of betrayal, but not swiftly enough, for his eyes gleamed, suddenly curious.
According to the Yankees, I ought to have a fine will. There seems to be considerable interest in my finances at present. Every day I'm hauled up before another board of inquiry and asked foolish questions. The rumor seems current that I made off with the mythical gold of the Confederacy.
Well, did you?
What a leading question. You know as well as I do that the Confederacy ran a printing press instead of a mint.
Where did you get all your money? Speculating? Aunt Pennypat said...
What probing questions you ask.
Damn him. Of course he had the money. She was so excited, it became difficult to talk sweetly to him. Rhett, I'm so upset about your being here. Don't you think there's a chance of your getting out?
Nihil desperandum is my motto.
What does that mean?
It means maybe, my charming ignoramus.
She fluttered her thick lashes up to look at him, and fluttered them down again. Oh, you're too smart to let them hang you. I know you'll think of some clever way to beat them and get out. And when you do...
And when I do? He asked softly, leaning closer.
Well, I...
She managed a pretty confusion and a blush. The blush wasn't difficult, for she was breathless, and her heart was beating like a drum.
Rhett, I'm so sorry about what I said to you that night. You know, at Rough and Ready, I was, oh, so very frightened and upset, and you were so... She looked down and saw his brown hand tighten over hers. And I thought then that I'd never, never forgive you. But when Aunt Petty told me yesterday that you... that they might hang you, it came over me of a sudden, and I... She looked up into his eyes with one swift, imploring glance, and in it she put an agony of heartbreak. Oh, Rhett, I'd die if they hanged you. I couldn't bear it. You see, I... And because she could not longer sustain the hot, leaping light that was in his eyes, her lids fluttered down again. In a moment I'll be crying, she thought, in a frenzy of wonder and excitement. Shall I let myself cry? Would that seem more natural? He said quickly,
My God, Scarlet, you can't mean that you...
His hands closed over hers in so hard a grip that it hurt. She shut her eyes tightly, trying to squeeze out tears, but remembered to turn her face up slightly so he could kiss her with no difficulty. Now, in an instant, his lips would be upon hers, the hard, insistent lips which she suddenly remembered with a vividness that left her weak. But he did not kiss her. Disappointment queerly stirring her. She opened her eyes a trifle and ventured a peep at him. His black head was bent over her hands, and as she watched, he lifted one and kissed it, and taking the other, laid it against his cheek for a moment. Expecting violence, this gentle and lover-like gesture startled her. She wondered what expression was on his face, but couldn't tell, for his head was bowed. She quickly lowered her gaze, lest he should look up suddenly and see the expression on her face. She knew that the feeling of triumph surging through her was certain to be plain in her eyes. In a moment he would ask her to marry him, or at least say that he loved her, and then, as she watched him through the veil of her lashes, he turned her hand over, palm up, to kiss it too. And suddenly he drew a quick breath.
Looking down, she saw her own palm, saw it as it really was for the first time in a year, and a cold, sinking fear gripped her. This was a stranger's palm, not Scarlett O'Hara's soft, white, dimpled, helpless one. This hand was rough from work, brown with sunburn, splotched with freckles. The nails were broken and irregular. There were heavy calluses on the cushions of the palm, a half-healed blister on the thumb. The red scar which boiling fat had left last month was ugly and glaring. She looked at it in horror, and before she thought, she swiftly clenched her fist. Still, he did not raise his head. Still, she could not see his face. He pried her fist open inexorably and stared at it, picked up her other hand and held them both together, silently, looking down at them. "Look at me," he said finally, raising his head, and his voice was very quiet. "And drop that demure expression." Unwillingly, she met his eyes, defiance and perturbation on her face. His black brows were up and his eyes gleamed. "So you have been doing very nicely at Terra, have you? Cleared so much money on the cotton you can go visiting. What have you been doing with your hands? Plowing?" She tried to wrench them away, but he held them hard, running his thumbs over the calluses. "These are not the hands of a lady," he said, and tossed them into her lap. "Oh, shut up!" she cried, feeling a momentary intense relief at being able to speak her feelings. "Whose business is it what I do with my hands?" "What a fool I am," she thought vehemently. "I should have borrowed or stolen Aunt Pitty's gloves. But I didn't realize my hands looked so bad. Of course he would notice them. And now I've lost my temper and probably ruined everything. Oh, to have this happen when he was right at the point of a declaration!" "Your hands are certainly no business of mine," said Brett coolly, and lounged back in his chair indolently, his face a smooth blank. So he was going to be difficult. Well, she'd have to bear it meekly, much as she disliked it, if she expected to snatch victory from this debacle. Perhaps if she sweet-talked him. "I think you're real rude to throw off on my poor hands, just because I went riding last week without my gloves and ruined them."
"Riding? Hell!" he said in the same level voice. "You've been working with those hands, working like a nigger. What's the answer? Why did you lie to me about everything being nice at Terra?"
"Now, Rhett, suppose we get down to the truth.
What is the real purpose of your visit? Almost, I was persuaded by your coquettish airs that you cared something about me and were sorry for me."
"Oh, I am sorry. Indeed."
"No, you aren't. They can hang me higher than Haman for all you care. It's written as plainly on your face as hard work is written on your hands. You wanted something from me, and you wanted it badly enough to put on quite a show. Why didn't you come out in the open and tell me what it was? You'd have stood a much better chance of getting it, for if there's one virtue I value in women, it's frankness. But no, you had to come jingling your earbobs and pouting and frisking like a prostitute with a prospective client. He didn't raise his voice at the last words or emphasize them in any way, but to Scarlet, they cracked like a whiplash. And with despair, she saw the end of her hopes of getting him to propose marriage. Had he exploded with rage and injured vanity, or upbraided her, as other men would have done, she could have handled him. But the deadly quietness of his voice frightened her, left her utterly at a loss as to her next move. Although he was a prisoner and the Yankees were in the next room, it came to her suddenly that Rhett Butler was a dangerous man to run afoul of. "I suppose my memory is getting faulty. I should have recalled that you are just like me, and that you never do anything without an ulterior motive. Now let me see. What could you have had up your sleeve, Mrs. Hamilton? It isn't possible that you were so misguided as to think I would propose matrimony." Her face went crimson, and she did not answer. "But you can't have forgotten my oft-repeated remark that I am not a marrying man." When she did not speak, he said with sudden violence, "You hadn't forgotten? Answer me." "I hadn't forgotten," she said wretchedly. "What a gambler you are, Scarlet," he jeered. "You took a chance that my incarceration away from female companionship would put me in such a state I'd snap at you like a trout at a worm." And that's what you did, thought Scarlet, with inward rage. "And if it hadn't been for my hands..." "Now, we have most of the truth. Everything except your reason. See if you can tell me the truth about why you wanted to lead me into wedlock." There was a suave, almost teasing note in his voice, and she took heart. Perhaps everything wasn't lost, after all. Of course, she had ruined any hope of marriage, but even in her despair she was glad. There was something about this immobile man which frightened her, so that now the thought of marrying him was fearful. But perhaps, if she was clever and played on his sympathies and his memories, she could secure a loan. She pulled her face into a placating and childlike expression. "Oh, Rhett, you can help me so much, if you'll just be sweet."
"There's nothing I like better than being sweet."
"Rhett, for old friendship's sake, I want you to do me a favor."
So, at last the horny-handed lady comes to her real mission. I feared that visiting the sick and the imprisoned was not your proper role. What do you want? Money? The bluntness of his question ruined all hopes of leading up to the matter in any circuitous and sentimental way.
"Don't be mean, Rhett," she coaxed. "I do want some money. I want you to lend me $300.
The truth at last. Talking love and thinking money. How truly feminine. Do you need the money badly?"
"Oh, yeah. Well, not so terribly, but I could use it."
$300? That's a vast amount of money. What do you want it for?"
"To pay taxes on Terra."
"So you want to borrow some money? Well, since you're so businesslike, I'll be businesslike, too. What collateral will you give me?"
What?
"Collateral. Security on my investment. Of course, I don't want to lose all that money."
His voice was deceptively smooth, almost silky. But she didn't notice. Maybe everything would turn out nicely after all. "My earrings?"
"I'm not interested in earrings."
"I'll give you a mortgage on Terra." Now, just what would I do with a farm?
Well, you could, it's a good plantation, and you wouldn't lose. I'd pay you back out of next year's cotton.
I'm not so sure. He tilted back in his chair and stuck his hands in his pockets. Cotton prices are dropping. Times are so hard and money's so tight.
Oh, Rhett, you're teasing me. You know you have millions.
There was a warm, dancing malice in his eyes as he surveyed her. So everything is going nicely, and you don't need the money very badly. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I like to know that all is well with old friends.
Oh, Rhett, for God's sake!
She began desperately, her courage and control breaking. Do lower your voice. You don't want the Yankees to hear you, I hope. Did anyone ever tell you you had eyes like a cat? A cat in the dark?
Rhett, don't. I'll tell you everything. I do need the money so badly I lied about everything being all right. Everything's as wrong as it could be. Father is... He's not himself. He's been queer ever since Mother died, and he can't help me any. He's just like a child. And we haven't a single field hand to work the cotton, and there's so many to feed. 13 of us. And the taxes, they're so high. Rhett, I'll tell you everything. For over a year, we've been just this sad of starvation. Oh, you don't know. You can't know. We've never had enough to eat, and it's terrible to wake up hungry and go to sleep hungry. And we haven't any warm clothes, and the children are always cold and sick, and...
Where did you get the pretty dress?
It's made out of Mother's curtains, she answered, too desperate to lie about this shame. I could stand being hungry and cold, but now the carpetbaggers have raised our taxes, and the money's got to be paid right away. And I haven't any money except one $5 gold piece. I've got to have money for the taxes, don't you see? If I don't pay them, we'll lose Tara. And we just can't lose it. I can't let it go.
Why didn't you tell me all this at first instead of preying on my susceptible heart? Always weak where pretty ladies are concerned. No, Scarlet, don't cry. You've tried every trick except that one, and I don't think I could stand it. My feelings are already lacerated with disappointment at discovering it was my money and not my charming self you wanted. She remembered that he frequently told bald truths about himself when he spoke mockingly, mocking himself as well as others, and she hastily looked up at him. Were his feelings really hurt? Did he really care about her? Had he been on the verge of a proposal when he saw her palms? Or had he only been leading up to another such odious proposal as he had made twice before? If he really cared about her, perhaps she could smooth him down. But his black eyes raked her in no lover-like way, and he was laughing softly. I don't like your collateral. I'm no planter. What else have you to offer? Well, she had come to it at last. Now for it. She drew a deep breath and met his eyes squarely, all coquetry and airs gone as her spirit rushed out to grapple that which she feared most. I have myself. Yes. Her jawline tightened to squareness, and her eyes went emerald. You remember that night on Aunt Pitty's porch, during the siege? You said then that you wanted me. He leaned back carelessly in his chair, and looked into her tense face, and his own dark face was inscrutable. Something flickered behind his eyes, but he said nothing. You said you'd never wanted a woman as much as you wanted me.
If you still want me, you can have me. Rhett, I'll do anything you say, but for God's sake, write me a draft for the money. My word's good, I swear it. I won't go back on it. I'll put it in writing if you like. He looked at her oddly, still inscrutable. And as she hurried on, she couldn't tell if he were amused or repelled. If he would only say something, anything. She felt her cheeks getting hot. I've got to have the money soon, Rhett. They'll turn us out in the road, and that damned overseer of father's will own the place, and...
Just a minute.
What makes you think I still want you? What makes you think you're worth $300?
Most women don't come that high.
She blushed to her hairline, and her humiliation was complete.
Why are you doing this? Why not let the farm go and live at Miss Pittypat's? You own half that house.
Name of God, she cried. Are you a fool? I can't let Tara go. It's home. I won't let it go. Not while I've got a breath left in me.
The Irish, he said, lowering his chair back to level and removing his hands from his pockets. Are the damnedest race. They put so much emphasis on so many wrong things. Land, for instance. And every bit of earth is just like every other bit. Now let me get this straight, Scarlet. You're coming to me with a business proposition. I'll give you $300, and you'll become my mistress.
Yes. Now that the repulsive word had been said, she felt somehow easier, and hope awoke in her again.